insistence on chicken soup and toast. But with all the urgency he could suffer, he dropped his shorts and sat down just in time. Simultaneously, his upper GI seemed to explode as well, and the former golf pro doubled over, vomiting on the tiles. There was an instant's embarrassment at having done so unmanly a thing. Then he saw what was there at his feet. "Honey," he called weakly. "Help." Chapter 48. Hemorrhage. 6 hours of sleep, maybe a little more, was better than nothing. This morning, Kathy got up first, and the father of the first family came into the breakfast room unshaven, following the smell of coffee. "When you feel this rotten, you should at least have a hangover to blame it on," the president announced. His morning papers were in the usual place. A post-it note was affixed to the front page of the Washington Post, just over an article bylined to Bob Holtzman and John Plummer. Now there was something to start off his day, Jack told himself. "That's really sleazy," Sally Ryan said. She'd already heard TV coverage of the controversy. "What finks?" She would have said dicks, a newly favored term among the young ladies at St. Mary's School, but Dad wasn't ready to acknowledge the fact that his Sally was talking like a grown-up. "Uh-huh," her father replied. The story gave far more detail than was possible in a couple of minutes of airtime. And it named Ed Keelty, who had, it seemed, unsurprisingly, but still against the law, a CIA source who had leaked information, which, the story explained, had not been entirely truthful, and, even worse, had been a deliberate political attack on the president, using the media as an attack dog. Jack snorted, as though that were new. The Post's emphasis was on the gross violation of journalistic integrity. Plummer's recantation of his actions was very sincere, it said. The article said that senior executives at NBC's news division had declined comment, pending their own inquiry. It also said that the Post had custody of the tapes, which were entirely undamaged. The Washington Times, he saw, was just as irate, but not in quite the same way. There would be a colossal internecine battle in the Washington press corps over this, something, the Times editorial observed, that the politicians would clearly watch with amusement. Well, Ryan told himself, that ought to keep them off my back for a while. Next, he opened the manila folder with the secret tape borders on it. This document, he saw, was pretty old. "Bastards," POTUS whispered. "They really did it to themselves this time," Kathy said, reading her own paper. "No," Swordsman replied. "China." It wasn't an epidemic yet, because nobody knew about it. Doctors were already reacting in surprise to telephone calls. Excited, if not frantic, calls to answering services had already awakened over 20 of them across the country. Bloody vomit and diarrhea were reported in every case, but only one to a customer, and there were various medical problems that could explain that. Bleeding ulcers, for example, and many of the calls came from business people for whom stress came with the tie and white shirt. Most were told to drive to the nearest hospital's emergency room, and in nearly all cases the doctor got dressed to meet his or her patient there, or to have a trusted associate do so. Some were instructed to be at the office first thing, usually between 8 and 9 in the morning, to be the first patient of the day and thus not interfere with the daily schedule. Gus Lawrence hadn't felt like being in his office alone, and had called in a few senior staff members to join him at his computer. They noted that his pipe was lit when they came in. One of them might have objected, it was contrary to federal regulations, but she stopped short, looking at the image on the screen. "Where's this one from?" the epidemiologist asked. "Chicago." "Our Chicago?" Pierre Alexander arrived at his office on the 11th floor of the Ross Building just before 8. His morning routine began with checking his fax machine. Attending physicians with AIDS cases regularly sent him patient information that way. It allowed him to monitor a large number of patients, both to advise treatment options and to increase his own knowledge base. There was only one fax this morning, and it was relatively good news. Merck had just fielded a new drug, which the FDA was fast-tracking into clinical trials, and a friend of his at Penn State was reporting some interesting results. That's when his phone rang.
Dr. Alexander,
this is the ER, sir. Could you come down here? I got a patient here, Caucasian male, 37. High fever, internal bleeding.
I don't know what this is.
The resident said.
I know what it looks like, but...
Give me 5 minutes.
Yes, sir, she acknowledged.
The internist, virologist, molecular biologist donned his starched lab coat, buttoned it, and headed down toward the emergency room, which was in a separate building on the sprawling Hopkins campus. Even in the military, he'd dressed the same way. The doctor look, he called it. Stethoscope in the right side pocket, name embroidered onto the left side, a calm expression on his face as he walked into the largely idle ER. Nighttime was the busy period here. There she was, cute as a button, putting on a surgical mask, he saw. What could be all that wrong this early on a spring day?
"Good morning, doctor," he said in his most charming Creole accent. "What seems to be the problem?"
She handed him the chart and started talking while he read.
His wife brought him in. High fever, some disorientation. BP is low. Probable internal bleed. Bloody vomit and stool. And there are some marks on his face, she reported. And I'm not sure enough to say.
Okay, let's take a look.
She sounded like a promising young doc, Alexander thought pleasantly. She knew what she didn't know, and she'd called for consultation. But why not one of the internal medicine guys? The former colonel asked himself, taking another look at her face. He put on mask and gloves and walked past the isolation curtain.
"Good morning, I'm Dr. Alexander," he said to the patient.
The man's eyes were listless, but it was the marks on his cheeks that made Alexander's breath stop. It was George Westfall's face, come back from more than a decade in Alex's past.
"How did he get here?"
"His personal physician told his wife to drive him in. He has privileges at Hopkins."
"What's he do? News photographer? Diplomat? Something to do with traveling?"
The resident shook her head. "He sells Winnebagos, RVs and like that. Dealership over on Pulaski Highway."
Alexander looked around the area. There were a medical student and two nurses, in addition to the resident who was running the case. All gloved, all masked. Good. She was smart, and now Alex knew why she was scared.
"Blood?"
"Already taken, doctor. Doing the cross-match now, and specimens for analysis in your lab." The professor nodded.
"Good. Admit him right now. My unit. I need a container for the tubes. Be careful with all the sharps." A nurse went off to get the things.
"Professor, it looks like... it can't be, but..."
"It can't be," he agreed. "But it does look that way. Those are petechiae, right out of the book. So we'll treat it like it is for the moment, okay?"
The nurse returned with the proper containers. Alexander took the extra blood specimens.
"As soon as you send him upstairs, everybody strip, everybody scrub. There's not that much danger involved as long as you take the proper precautions. Is his wife around?"
"Yes, doctor, out in the waiting room."
"Have somebody bring her up to my office. I have to ask her some things."
"Questions?"
There were none.
"Then let's get moving." Dr. Alexander visually checked the plastic container for the blood and tucked it into the left side pocket of his lab coat, after determining that it was properly sealed. The calm doctor's look was gone as he walked to the elevator. Looking at the burnished steel of the automatic doors, he told himself that no, this wasn't possible. Maybe something else. But what? Leukemia had some of the same symptoms, and as dreaded as that diagnosis was, it was preferable to what it looked like to him. The doors opened, and he headed off to his lab.
"Morning, Janet," he said, walking into the hot lab.
"Alex," replied Janet Clemenger, a Ph.D. molecular biologist.
He took the plastic box from his pocket.
I need this done in a hurry, like immediately.
What is it?
She wasn't often told to stop everything she was doing, especially at the start of a working day.
Looks like hemorrhagic fever. Treated as level 4.
Her eyes went a little wide.
Here?
People were asking the same question all over America, but none of them knew it yet.
They should be bringing the patient up now. I have to talk to his wife.
She took the container and set it gently on the work table.
The usual antibody tests?
Yes. And please be careful with it, Janet.
Always, she assured him.
Like Alexander, she worked a lot of AIDS experiments. Alexander went next to his office to call Dave James.
How certain are you? The dean asked 2 minutes later.
Dave, it's just a heads up for now, but I've seen it before. Just like it was with George Westfall. I have Jan Clemenger working on it right now. Until further notice, I think we have to take this one seriously.
If the lab results are what I expect, I get on the phone to Gus and we declare a for real alert.
Well, Ralph gets back from London day after tomorrow. It's your department for the moment, Alex. Keep me posted.
Roger, the former soldier said.
Then it was time to speak to the patient's wife.
In the emergency room, orderlies were scrubbing the floor where the bed had been, overseen by the ER charge nurse. Overhead, they could hear the distinctively powerful sound of a Sikorsky helicopter. The First Lady was coming to work.
The courier arrived at CDC, carrying his hatbox, and handed it over to one of Lawrence's lab technicians. From there, everything was fast-tracked. The antibody tests were already set up on the lab benches, and under exquisitely precise handling precautions, a drop of blood was dipped into a small glass tube. The liquid in the tube changed color almost instantly.
"It's Ebola, doctor," the technician reported.
In another room, a sample was being set up for the scanning electron microscope. Lawrence walked there, his legs feeling tired for so early in the morning. The instrument was already switched on. It was just a matter of getting things aimed properly before the images appeared on the TV display.
Take your pick, Gus.
This was a senior physician, not a lab tech. As the magnification was adjusted, the picture was instantly clear. This blood sample was alive with the tiny strands. And soon it would be alive with nothing else.
Where's this one from?
Chicago, Lawrence answered.
Welcome to the new world, he told the screen, as he worked the fine control to isolate one particular strand for full magnification.
You little son of a bitch.
Next came a closer examination to see if they could subtype it. That would take a while.
And so he has not traveled out of the country? Alex was running down his list of stock questions.
No, no, he hasn't, she assured him. Just to the big RV show. He goes to that every year.
Ma'am, I have to ask a number of questions, and some of them may seem offensive. Please understand that I have to do this in order to help your husband.
She nodded. Alexander had a quiet way of getting past that problem.
Do you have any reason to suspect that your husband has been seeing other women?
No.
Sorry, I had to ask that. Do you have any exotic pets?
Just 2 Chesapeake Bay Retrievers, she replied, surprised at the question.
Monkeys? Anything from out of the country?
No, nothing like that.
This isn't going anywhere. Alex couldn't think of another relevant question. They were supposed to say yes to the travel one.
Do you know anybody, family member, friend, whatever, who does a lot of traveling?
No. Can I see him?
Yes, you can, but first we have to get him settled into his room and get some treatment going.
Is he going to... I mean, he's never been sick at all. He runs and doesn't smoke and doesn't drink much, and we've always been careful.
And then she started losing control. I won't lie to you. Your husband appears to be a very sick man, but your family doctor sent you to the best hospital in the world. I just started here. I spent more than 20 years in the Army, all of that in the area of infectious diseases.
So you are in the right place, and I am the right doc. You had to say things like that, empty words though they might be. The one thing you could never, ever do was take hope away. The phone rang. Dr. Alexander.
Alex, it's Janet. Antibody test is positive for Ebola. I ran it twice, she told him. I have the spare tube package to go to CDC, and the microscopy will be ready to go in about 15 minutes.
Very well, I'll be over for that. He hung up. Here, he told the patient's wife. Let me get you out to the waiting room and introduce you to the nurses. We have some very good ones on my unit.
This was not the fun part, even though infectious diseases was not a particularly fun field. In trying to give her hope, he'd probably given her too much. Now she'd listened to him, thinking that he spoke with God's voice, but right now God didn't have any answers. And next he had to explain to her that the nurses would be taking some of her blood for examination, too.
What gives, Scott? Ryan asked across 13 time zones.
Well, they sure as hell tossed a wrench into it.
Jack?
Yes?
This guy's young. I've met him twice now. He doesn't talk a hell of a lot, but he's a bigger fish than we thought. I think he's the one keeping an eye on the foreign minister. He's a player, Mr. President. Tell the Foleys to open a file on the guy and put a big flag on it.
Will Taipei spring for compensation? Swordsman asked.
Would you?
My instinct would be to tell them where they could shove it, but I'm not supposed to lose my temper, remember?
They will listen to the demand, and then they will ask me where the United States of America stands. What do I tell them?
For the moment, we stand for renewed peace and stability.
I can make that last an hour, maybe 2 hours. Then what? Sextate persisted.
You know that area better than I do. What's the game, Scott?
I don't know. I thought I did, but I don't. First, I kinda hoped it was an accident. Then I thought they might be rattling their cage. Taiwan's, I mean. No, it's not that. They're pushing too hard and in the wrong way for that. Third option, they're doing all this to test you. If so, they're playing very rough. Too rough. They don't know you well enough yet, Jack. It's too big a pot for the first hand of the night. Bottom line, I do not know what they're thinking. Without that, I can't tell you how to play it out.
We know they were behind Japan. Zhang personally was behind that Yamada bastard, and...
Yes, I know. And they must know that we know, and that's one more reason not to piss us off.
There are a lot of chips on the table, Jack, Adler emphasized again, and I do not see a reason for this.
Tell Taiwan we're behind them?
Okay, if you do that and it gets out, and the PRC ups the ante, we have thousands, hell, close to 100,000 citizens over here, and they're hostages. I won't go into the trade considerations, but that's a big chip in political economic terms. But if we don't back Taiwan up, then they'll think they're on their own and cornered.
Yes, sir, and the same thing happens from the other direction.
My best suggestion is to ride with it. I deliver the demand, Taipei says no, then I suggest that they suggest the issue is held in abeyance until the issue of the airliner is determined. For that, we call in the UN. We, that is the United States, call the question before the Security Council. That strings it out. Sooner or later, their friggin' Navy's gotta run out of fuel. We have a carrier group in the neighborhood, and so nothing can happen, really.
Ryan frowned.
I won't say I like it, but run with it. It'll last a day or two, anyway. My instinct is to back up Taiwan and tell the PRC to suck wind.
The world isn't that simple, and you know it, Adler's voice told him.
Ain't it the truth? Run with what you said, Scott, and keep me posted.
Yes, sir.
Alex checked his watch. Next to the electron microscope was Dr. Clemenger's notebook. At 10:16, she lifted it, made a time notation, and described how both she and her fellow associate professor confirmed the presence of the Ebola virus. On the other side of the lab, a technician was running a test on blood drawn from the wife of patient zero. It was positive for Ebola antibodies. She had it too, though she didn't know it yet.
They have any children? Janet asked when the news arrived.
Two, both away in school.
Alex, unless you know something I don't, I hope their insurance is paid up. Clemenger didn't quite have the status of an M.D. here, but at moments like this, she didn't mind. Physicians got to know the patients a lot better than the pure scientists did.
What else can you tell me?
I need to map the genes out a little, but look here. She tapped the screen. See the way the protein loops are grouped? And this structure down here?
Janet was the lab's top expert on how viruses were formed.
Mayinga?
Christ, that's what got George.
And nobody knew how George had gotten it, and he didn't know now how this patient...
Too early to be sure. You know what I have to do to run that down, but...
It fits. No known risk factors for him, maybe not for her either. Jesus, Janet. If this is airborne...
I know, Alex.
You call Atlanta or me. I'll do it.
I'll start picking the little bastard apart, she promised.
It seemed a long walk from the lab back to his office. His secretary was in now and noticed his mood.
Dr. Lawrence is in a meeting now, another secretary said. That usually put people off. Not this time.
Break in, if you would, please. Tell him it's Pierre Alexander at Johns Hopkins, and it's important.
Yes, doctor. Please hold.
She pressed one button and then another, ringing the line in the conference room down the hall.
Dr. Lawrence, please, it's urgent.
Yes, Marjorie?
I have Dr. Alexander holding on three. He says it's important, sir.
Thank you.
Gus switched lines.
Talk fast, Alex. We have a developing situation here, he said in an unusually businesslike voice.
I know. Ebola's made it to this side of the world, Alexander announced.
Have you been talking to Mark, too?
Mark?
Mark who? The professor asked.
Wait. Wait, back up, Alex.
Why did you call here?
We have two patients on my unit, and they've both got it, Gus.
In Baltimore?
Yes. Now what?
Where else, Gus?
Mark Klein in Chicago has one, female, 41. I've already micrographed the blood sample. In two widely separated cities, two world-class experts did exactly the same thing. One pair of eyes looked at a wall in a small office. The other pair looked down a conference table at 10 other physicians and scientists. The expressions were exactly the same.
Has either one been to Chicago or Kansas City?
Negative, the former colonel said.
When did Klein's case show up?
Last night, 10 or so. Yours?
Just before 8.
Husband has all the symptoms. Wife doesn't, but her blood's positive.
Oh, shit, Gus.
I have to call Dietrich next.
You do that.
Keep an eye on the fax machine, Gus, Professor Alexander advised, and hope it's all a fucking mistake. But it wasn't, and both knew it now.
Stay close to the phone. I may want your input.
You bet. Alex thought about that as he hung up. He had a call to make, too.
Dave, Alex.
Well, the dean asked.
Husband and wife both positive. Wife is not yet symptomatic. Husband is showing all the classic signs.
So what's the story, Alex? The dean asked guardedly.
Dave, the story is I caught Gus at a staff meeting. They were discussing an Ebola case in Chicago. Mark Klein called it in around midnight, I gather. No commonalities between that one and our index case here. I think we have a potential epidemic on our hands. We need to alert our emergency people. There might be some very dangerous stuff coming in.
Epidemic, but that's my call to make, Dave. CDC is talking to the Army.
I know what exactly they're going to say up at Dietrich. 6 months ago it would have been me making that call, too.
Alexander's other line started ringing. His secretary got it in the outer office. A moment later, her head appeared in the doorway.
Doctor, that's ER. They say they need you stat.
Alex relayed that message to the dean.
I'll meet you there, Alex, Dave James told him.
At the next call on your machine, you will be free to complete your mission, Mr. Alahad said. The timing is yours to decide. He didn't have to add that it would be better for him if Raymond erased all his messages.
To do so would have appeared venal to one who was willing to sacrifice himself. We will not meet again in this lifetime. I must go to my workplace. Raymond hesitated. So the order had really come after a fashion. The two men embraced, and the younger one took his leave.
Kathy? She looked up to see Bernie Katz's head sticking in her office door.
Yeah, Bernie?
Dave has called a department head meeting in his office at 2. I'm leaving for New York to do that conference at Columbia, and Hal's operating this afternoon. Sit in for me?
Sure, I'm clear.
Thanks, Kath. His head vanished again. Surgeon went back to her patient records. Actually, the dean had told his secretary to call the meeting on his way out the door. David James was in the emergency room. Behind the mask, he looked like any other physician. This patient had nothing at all to do with the other two. Watching from 10 feet away in a corner of the ER, already set aside for the situation, they watched him vomit into a plastic container. There was ample evidence of blood. It was the same young resident working this one, too.
No traveling to speak of.
Says he was in New York for some stuff. Theater, auto show, regular tourist stuff.
What about the first one?
Positive for Ebola virus, Alex told her. That snapped her head around like an owl's.
Here?
Here. Don't be too surprised, Doctor. You called me, remember? He turned to Dean James and raised an eyebrow. All department heads in my office at 2. I can't go any faster, Alex. A third of them are operating or seeing patients right now.
Ross for this one? The resident asked. She had a patient to deal with.
Quick as you can. Alexander took the dean by the arm and walked him outside. There, dressed in greens, he lit a cigar to the surprise of the security guards, who enforced a smoking ban out there.
What the hell's going on?
You know there is something to be said for these things. Alex took a few puffs. I can tell you what they're going to say up at Dietrich, sure as hell.
Go on.
2 separate index cases, Dave, 1,000 miles apart in distance and 8 hours apart in time. No connection of any kind. No commonalities at all. Think it through, Pierre Alexander said, taking another worried puff.
Not enough data to support it, James objected.
I hope I'm wrong. They're going to be scrambling down in Atlanta. Good people down there. The best. But they don't look at this sort of thing the way I do. I wore that green suit a long time.
Well, another puff.
We're going to see what the best possible supportive care can do. We're better than any place in Africa. So's Chicago. So are all the other places that are going to phone in, I suppose.
Others?
As fine a physician as he was, James still wasn't getting it.
The first attempt at biological warfare was undertaken by Alexander the Great. He launched bodies of plague victims into a besieged city with catapults. I don't know if it worked or not. He took the city anyway, slaughtered all the citizens, and moved on.
He got it now, Alex could see. The dean was as pale as the new patient inside.
Jeff? Raymond was in the local command post, going over the coming schedule for POTUS. He had a mission to complete now, and it was time to start doing some planning. Andrea walked over to him.
We have a trip to Pittsburgh on Friday. You want to hop up there with the advance team? There are a couple local problems that have cropped up at the hotel.
Okay, when do I leave? Agent Raymond asked.
Flight leaves in 90 minutes.
She handed him a ticket.
You get back tomorrow night.
How much the better, Raymond thought, if he might even survive.
Were he to structure all the security at one of these events, that might actually be possible. The idea of martyrdom didn't turn his head all that much. But if survival were possible, then he would opt for that.
Fair enough, the assassin replied.
He didn't have to worry about packing. The agents on the detail always had a bag in the car.
It took 3 satellite passes before NRO was willing to make its estimate of the situation. All 6 of the UIR heavy divisions which had participated in the war game were now in a full maintenance stand-down. Some might say that such a thing was normal. A unit went into a heavy maintenance cycle after a major training exercise,
but 6 divisions, 3 heavy corps, at once was a bit much. The data was immediately forwarded to the Saudi and Kuwaiti governments. In the meantime, the Pentagon called the White House.
"Yes, Mr. Secretary," Ryan said.
"The SNAI isn't ready yet for the UIR, but we have received, well, some disturbing information. I'll let Admiral Jackson present it."
The President listened, and didn't need much in the way of analysis, though he wished the Special National Intelligence Estimates were on his desk to give him a better feel for the UIR's political intentions.
"Recommendations?" he asked, when Robbie was done.
"I think it's a good time to get the boats at Diego moving. It never hurts to exercise them. We can move them to within 2 steaming days of the Gulf without anybody noticing. Next, I recommend that we issue warning orders to 18th Airborne Corps. That's the 82nd, 101st, and 24th Mechanized."
"Will it make noise?" Jack asked.
"No, sir. It's treated as a practice alert. We do those all the time. All it really does is to get staff officers thinking."
"Make it so. Keep it quiet."
"Well, this would be a good time to do a joint training exercise with friendly nations in the region," J3 suggested.
"I'll see about that. Anything else?"
"No, Mr. President," Brattano replied. "We'll keep you informed."
By noon, the fax count at CDC Atlanta was over 30, from 10 different states. These were forwarded to Fort Detrick, Maryland, home of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRID, the military counterpart to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. As chilling as the data was, it was just a little too chilling for snap judgment. A major staff meeting was called for just after lunch, while the commissioned officers and civilians tried to get their data organized. More senior officers from Walter Reed got in their staff cars for the ride up Interstate 70.
"Dr. Ryan?"
"Yes?"
Kathy looked up.
"The meeting in Dr. James's office has been moved up," her secretary said. "They want you over there right now."
"I guess I better head over then."
She stood and headed for the door. Roy Altman was standing there.
"Anything I need to know about?" Surgeon's principal agent asked.
"Something's up. I don't know what it is."
"Where is the dean's office?"
He'd never been there before. All of the staff meetings she'd attended recently were in Maumee.
"That way,"
she pointed. "Other side of Monument Street in the admin building."
"Surgeon is moving, going north to Monument."
The agents just appeared out of nowhere, it seemed. It might have seemed funny, except for recent events.
"If you don't mind, I'll stand in the room."
"I'll keep out of the way," Altman assured her.
Kathy nodded. There was no fighting it. He'd hate the dean's office for all the big windows there, she was sure. It was a 10-minute walk over, almost all of it under cover. She headed outdoors to cross the street, wanting a little fresh air. Entering the building, she saw a lot of her friends, either department chairman or senior staffers, standing in as she was doing. The director-level people were always traveling, one reason why she wasn't sure if she ever wanted to be that senior herself. Pierre Alexander stormed in wearing greens, carrying a folder, and looking positively grim as he almost bumped into her. A Secret Service agent prevented that.
"Glad you're here, Kathy," he said on the way past. "Them too."
"Nice to be appreciated," Altman observed to a colleague, as the dean appeared at the door. "Come in."
One look at the conference room convinced Altman to lower the shades with his own hands. The windows faced a street of anonymous brick houses. A few of the doctors looked on with annoyance, but they knew who he was and didn't object.
"Calling the meeting to order," Dave James said, before everyone was seated. "Alex has something important to tell us."
There was no preamble. "We have 5 Ebola cases in Ross right now. They all came in today." Heads turned sharply. Kathy blinked at her seat at the end of the table.
"Students from some place?" the surgery director asked. "Zaire?"
"One auto dealer and his wife, a boat salesman from Annapolis, 3 more people. Answering your question, no. No international travel at all. 4 of the 5 are fully symptomatic.
The auto dealer's wife shows antibodies, but no symptoms as yet. That's the good news. Our case wasn't the first. CDC has cases reported in Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and Dallas. That's as of an hour ago. Total reported cases is 20, and that number doubled between 10 and 11. Probably still going up.
Jesus Christ, the director of medicine whispered.
You all know what I did before I got here. Right now I imagine they're having a staff meeting at Fort Detrick. The conclusion from that meeting will be that this is not an accidental outbreak. Somebody has initiated a biological warfare campaign against our country.
Nobody objected to Alexander's analysis, Kathy saw. She knew why. The other physicians in the room were so bright that sometimes she wondered if she belonged on the same faculty with them. She had never considered that most of them might harbor the same thoughts. All of them were world experts in their fields, at least four the very best there was. But all of them also spent time as she did, having lunch with a colleague in a different field to exchange information, because, like her, they were all truly fanatical about learning. They all wanted to know everything, and even though they knew that such a thing was impossible, even within one professional field, that didn't stop them from trying. In this case, the suddenly rigid faces concealed the same analytical process. Ebola was an infectious disease, and such diseases started from a single place. There was always a first victim called Patient Zero, or the Index Case, and it spread from there. No disease just exploded in this way. CDC and USAMRID, which had to make that conclusion official, would have the duty to assemble, organize, and present information in what was almost a legalistic structure to prove their case. For their medical institution, it was simpler, all the more so because Alex had commanded one of the divisions at Fort Detrick. Moreover, since there was a plan for everything, Johns Hopkins was one of the institutions tapped to receive cases in the event something like this took place.
Alex, the director of urology, said, the literature says that Ebola is only spread by large particles of liquid. How could it explode so fast, even at the local level?
There's a substrain called Mayinga. It's named for a nurse who picked it up and died. The method of her infection was never determined. A colleague of mine, George Westfall, died of the same thing in 1990. We never determined the means of transmission in his case either. There is thought that this substrain may spread by aerosol. It's never been proven one way or the other, Alex explained. Besides, there are ways to fortify a virus, as you know. You admit some cancer genes into the structure.
And there's no treatment? Nothing experimental, even? Urology asked.
Rousseau is doing some interesting work at Pasteur, but so far he hasn't produced any positive results.
A physical reaction ripped down the conference table from one physician to another. They were among the best in the world, and they knew it. They also knew now that it didn't matter against this enemy.
How about a vaccine? Medicine asked. That shouldn't be too hard.
USAMRID has been playing with that for about 10 years. The first issue is that there seems to be a specificity problem. What works for one substrain may not always work with another. Also, the quality control issue is a killer. Studies I've seen predict a 2% infection rate from the vaccine itself. Merck thinks they can do better, but trials take time to run.
Ouch, Surgery commented with a wince.
Giving one person out of 50 a disease with an 80% mortality rate, 20,000 people infected per million doses, of whom roughly 16,000 might die from it. Applied to the population of the United States, it could mean 3 million deaths from an attempt to safeguard the population.
Hobson's choice.
But it's too early to determine the extent of the notional epidemic, and we do not have hard data on the ability of the disease to spread in existing environmental conditions, Urology thought. So we really aren't sure what measures need to be taken yet.
Correct.
At least it was easy to explain things to these people.
My people will see it first, Emergency said. I have to get them warned. We can't risk losing our people unnecessarily.
Who tells Jack? Kathy wondered aloud. He's got to know, and he's got to know fast.
Well, that's the job of USAMRID and the Surgeon General.
They're not ready to make the call yet.
You just said that, Kathy replied.
You're sure about this?
Yes.
Surgeon turned to Roy Altman. Get my helicopter up here, stat.
Chapter 49 Reaction Time. Colonel Goodman was surprised by the call. He was having a late lunch after a check flight for a spare VH-60 just out of the maintenance shop for engine replacement. The one he used for surgeon was on the ramp. The three-man crew walked out to it and spooled up the engines, not knowing why the schedule for the day had changed. 10 minutes after the call, he was airborne and heading northeast. 20 minutes after that, he was circling the landing pad. Well, there was Surgeon, with Sandbox by her side, and the Secret Service squad. And one other he didn't know, wearing a white coat. The colonel checked the wind and began his descent. The faculty meeting had gone on until 5 minutes before. Decisions had to be made. 2 complete medical floors would be cleared and tooled up for possible Ebola arrivals. The director of emergency medicine was even now assembling his staff for a lecture. 2 of Alexander's people were on the phone to Atlanta, getting updates on the total number of known cases, and announcing that Hopkins had activated its emergency plan for this contingency. It meant that Alex hadn't been able to go to his office and change clothes. Kathy was wearing her lab coat, too, but in her case it was over a normal dress. He'd been wearing greens, his 3rd set of the day, for the meeting, and still was. Kathy told him not to worry about it. They had to wait for the rotor to stop before the Secret Service allowed their protectees to board the aircraft. Alex noted the presence of a backup chopper circling a mile away, and a 3rd circling closer in. It looked like a police bird, probably for security, he imagined. Everyone was bundled aboard. Katie, he'd never met her before, got the jump seat behind the pilots, supposedly the safest place on the aircraft. Alexander hadn't ridden in a Black Hawk in years. The 4-point safety belt still worked, though. Kathy snapped hers right in place. Little Katie had to be helped, but she loved her helmet, painted pink, with a bunny on it, doubtless some Marine's idea. Seconds later, the rotor started turning.
"This is going a little fast," Alex said over the intercom.
"You really think we should wait?" Kathy replied, keying her microphone.
"No."
And it wouldn't do to say that he wasn't dressed for seeing the president. The aircraft lifted off, climbed about 300 feet, and turned south.
"Colonel," Kathy said to the pilot in the right front seat.
"Yes, ma'am?"
"Make it fast," she ordered.
Goodman had never heard Surgeon talk like a surgeon before. It was a voice of command that any Marine would recognize. He dropped the nose and brought the Black Hawk to 160 knots.
"You in a hurry, Colonel?" the backup chopper called. "The lady is. Bravo routing, direct approach."
Next he called to BWI Airport to tell the controllers to hold arrivals and departures until he'd passed overhead. It wouldn't take long. Nobody on the ground really noticed, but 2 U.S. Air 737s had to go around once, to the annoyance of their passengers. Watching from the jump seat, Sandbox thought it was pretty neat.
"Mr. President?"
"Yes, Andrea." Ryan looked up.
"Your wife is inbound from Baltimore. She needs to see you about something. I don't know what."
"About 15 minutes," Price told him.
"Nothing's wrong?" Jack asked.
"No, no, everything's fine, sir."
"Sandbox is with her," the agent assured him.
"Okay." Ryan went back to the most recent update of the investigation.
"Well, it's officially a clean shoot, Pat." Murray wanted to tell his inspector that himself. There hadn't been much doubt of that, of course.
"Wish I could have taken the last one alive," O'Day remarked with a grimace.
"You can stow that one. There was no chance, not with kids around. I think we'll probably arrange a little decoration for you."
"We have anything on that Azir guy yet?"
"His driver's license photo and a lot of written records, but aside from that, we'd have a hard time proving he ever existed." It was a classic set of circumstances. Sometime Friday afternoon, Mordecai Azir had driven his car to Baltimore Washington International Airport and caught a flight to New York Kennedy. They knew that much from the U.S. Air desk clerk who'd issued him the ticket in that name. Then he'd disappeared, like a cloud of smoke on a windy day. He doubtless had had a virgin set of travel documents. Maybe he'd used them in New York for an international flight. If he'd really been smart, he would have caught a cab to Newark or LaGuardia first, and taken an overseas flight from the former, or maybe a flight to Canada from the latter. Even now, agents from the New York office were interviewing people at every airline counter. But nearly every airline in the world came into Kennedy, and the clerks there saw thousands per day. Maybe they would establish what flight he'd taken. If so, he'd be on the moon before they managed that feat.
"Train spook," Pat O'Day observed. "It's really not all that hard, is it?"
What came back to Murray were the words of his FCI chief. "If you could do it once, you could do it more than once." There was every reason to believe that there was a complete espionage, worse, a terrorist network in his country, sitting tight and waiting for orders. To do what? And, to avoid detection, all its members really had to do was nothing. Samuel Johnson had once remarked that everybody could manage that feat. The helicopter flared and landed, rather to the surprise of the newspeople who always kept an eye out. Anything unexpected at the White House was newsworthy. They recognized Kathy Ryan. Her white doctor's coat was unusual, however. And on seeing another person dressed in the same way but wearing greens, the immediate impression was of a medical emergency involving the president. This was actually correct, though a spokesman came over to say that no, the president was fine, working at his desk. No, he didn't know why Dr. Ryan had come home early.
"I'm not dressed for this," Alex thought.
The looks of the agents on the way to the West Wing confirmed that. And now a few of them wondered if Swordsman might be ill, resulting in a few radio calls that were immediately rebuffed. Kathy led him down the corridor, then tried the wrong door until an agent pointed and opened the one into the Oval Office. They noted that she didn't bother with anger or embarrassment at the mistake. They'd never seen surgeons so focused.
"Jack, this is Pierre Alexander," she said without a greeting.
Ryan stood. He didn't have any major appointments for another 2 hours, and had shed his suit coat.
"Hello, doctor," he said, extending his hand and taking in the manner of his visitor's dress. Then he realized that Kathy had her work coat on as well.
"What's going on, Kathy?" he asked his wife.
"Alex?"
Nobody had even sat down yet. Two Secret Service agents had followed the physicians in, and the tension in the room was like an alarm bell for them, though they didn't know what was going on either. Roy Altman was in another room talking to Price.
"Mr. President, do you know what the Ebola virus is?"
"Africa," Jack said. "Some jungle disease, right? Deadly as hell. I saw a movie."
"Pretty close," Alexander confirmed. "It's a negative strand RNA virus. We don't know where it lives. I mean, we know the place, but not the host. That's the animal it lives in," he explained. "And it's a killer, sir. The crude mortality rate is 80%.
"Okay," POTUS said, still standing. "Go on."
"It's here now."
"Where?"
"At last count we had 5 cases at Hopkins. More than 20 countrywide. That number is about 3 hours old now. Can I use the phone?"
Gus Lawrence was alone in his office when the phone rang.
"It's Dr. Alexander again."
"Yes, Alex."
"Gus, what's the count now?"
67, the speakerphone replied. Alex was leaning over it.
"Where?"
"Mainly big cities. The reports are coming in mostly from major medical centers. Boston, New Haven, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, 1 in Richmond, 7 right here in Atlanta, 3 in Orlando."
They could hear a door open and a paper being handled.
89, Alex. They're still coming in."
"Has USAMRID put the alert out yet?"
I expect that within the hour. They are having a meeting to determine. Gus, I am in the White House right now. The President is here with me. I want you to tell him what you think, Alexander commanded, speaking like an army colonel again.
What? How did you... Alex, it's not sure yet.
Either you say it or I will. Better that you do.
Mr. President?
It was Ellen Sumter at the side door.
I have a General Pickett on the phone for you, sir. He says it's most urgent.
Tell him to stand by. John's good, but he's a little conservative, Alex observed. Gus, talk to us.
Sir, Mr. President, this appears to be something other than a natural event. It looks very much like a deliberate act.
Biological warfare? Ryan asked.
Yes, Mr. President. Our data isn't yet complete enough for a real conclusion, but naturally occurring epidemics don't start this way. Not all over the place.
Mrs. Sumter, can you put the general on this line?
Yes, sir.
Mr. President? A new voice asked.
General, I have a Dr. Lorenz on the line, and next to me is Dr. Alexander from up the road at Hopkins.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, John, Alexander responded.
Then you know.
How confident are you in this estimate? Swordsman asked.
We have at least 10 focal centers. A disease doesn't get around like that by itself. The data is still coming in, sir. All these cases appearing in 24 hours, it's no accident, and it's no natural process. You have Alex there to explain things further. He used to work for me. He's pretty good, Pickett told his commander-in-chief.
Dr. Lorenz, you concur in this?
Yes, Mr. President.
Jesus.
Jack looked at his wife.
What's next?
Sir, we have some options, Pickett replied. I need to get down to see you.
Ryan turned.
Andrea.
Yes, sir?
Get a chopper up to Fort Detrick right now.
Yes, Mr. President.
I'll be waiting, General. Dr. Lorenz, thank you. Anything else I need to know now?
Dr. Alexander can handle that.
Very well. I will put Mrs. Sumter on the phone to give you the direct lines to this office.
Jack walked to the door.
Get on and give them what they need. Then get Arnie and Ben in here.
Yes, Mr. President.
Jack walked back to sit on the edge of his desk. He was silent for a moment. In a way, he was now grateful for the failed attack on his daughter. That had hit him with a dreadful immediacy. This one, as yet, had not. And though intellectually he knew that the ramifications were far worse, he didn't need the emotional impact for the time being.
What do I need to know?
Most of the important stuff we can't tell you yet. The issues are technical, Alex explained. How easily the disease spreads, all we have now is anecdotal and unreliable. That's the key issue. If it spreads easily by aerosol...
What's that? POTUS asked.
Spray, little droplets, like a cough or a sneeze. If it spreads that way, we're in very deep trouble.
It's not supposed to, Kathy objected. Jack, this bug is very delicate. It doesn't last in the open for more than...
What, Alex, a few seconds?
Well, that's the theory. But some strains are more robust than others. Even if it can survive just a few minutes in the open, that's pretty damn bad. If this is a strain we call Mayinga, well, we just don't know how robust it is. But it goes farther than that. Once a person gets it, then they take it home. A house is a pretty benign environment for pathogens. We have heating and air conditioning to make it that way, and family members are in close contact. They hug, they kiss, they make love. And once somebody has it in their system, they're always pumping the things out.
Things?
Virus particles, Mr. President. The size of these things is measured in microns. They're far smaller than dust particles, smaller than anything you can see.
You used to work at Detrick?
Yes, sir, I was a colonel, head of pathogens. I retired, and Hopkins hired me.
So you have an idea what General Pickett's plans are? The options, I mean?
Yes, sir. That stuff is reevaluated at least once a year. I've sat in on the committee that draws the plans up.
Sit down, Doctor. I want to hear this.
The maritime preposition ships had just gotten back from an exercise, and what little maintenance had been required was already done.
On receiving orders from Sinclant Fleet, they initiated engine start procedures, which mainly meant warming up the fuel and lubricating oils. To the north, the cruiser Anzio, plus destroyers Kidd and O'Bannon, got orders of their own and turned west for a projected rendezvous point. The senior officer present was the skipper of the Aegis cruiser, who wondered how the hell he was supposed to get those fat merchants into the Persian Gulf without air cover, if it came to that. The United States Navy didn't go anywhere without air cover, and the nearest carrier was Ike, 3,000 miles away, with Malaya in the way. On the other hand, it wasn't all that bad to be a mere captain in command of a task force without an admiral to look over his shoulder. The first of the MPS ships to sortie from the large anchorage was USNS Bob Hope, a newly built military-type roll-on, roll-off transport displacing close to 80,000 tons and carrying 952 vehicles. Her civilian crew had a little tradition for their movements. Oversized speakers blared thanks for the memories at the naval base as she passed by just after midnight, followed by four of her sisters. Aboard they had the full vehicle complement for a reinforced heavy brigade. Passing the reef-marked entrance, the handles were pushed down on the annunciators, demanding 26 knots of the big Colt peel-stick diesels. They waited for Goodley and Van Damme to come in, and then it took 10 minutes to bring them up to speed on what was going on. By this time, the enormity of it was sinking into the President's consciousness, and he had to struggle with emotions now in addition to intellect. He noted that Kathy, though she had to be as horrified as he was taking everything calmly, at least outwardly so. Well, it was her field, wasn't it? "I didn't think Ebola could survive outside a jungle," Goodley said. "It can't. At least not long-term, or it would have traveled around the world by now."
"It kills too fast for that," Surgeon objected.
"Kathy, we've had jet travel for over 30 years now. This little bastard is delicate. That works for us."
"How do we find out who did it?" This came from Arnie.
"We interview all the victims, find out where they've been, and try to narrow the focal centers down to one point if we can. That's an investigative function. Epidemiologists are pretty good at that. But this one's a little big," Alexander added.
"Could the FBI help, Doctor?" Van Damme asked.
"Can't hurt."
"I'll get Murray over here," the chief of staff told the president.
"You can't treat it?" POTUS asked.
"No, what happens is the epidemic burns itself out over several generational cycles. What I mean by that...
Okay, one person gets it. The virus reproduces in them, and then they pass it on to somebody else. Every victim becomes an imperfect host. As the disease reproduces and kills the victim passes it on to the next one. But, and here's the good news, Ebola doesn't reproduce efficiently. As it goes through these generational cycles, it becomes less virulent. Most of the survivors in an outbreak happen toward the end, because the virus progressively mutates itself into a less dangerous form. The organism is so primitive that it doesn't do everything well."
"How many cycles before that happens, Alex?" Kathy asked.
He shrugged.
"It's empirical. We know the process, but we can't quantify it."
"Lots of unknowns," she grimaced.
"Mr. President?"
"Yes, Doctor."
"The movie you saw?"
"What about it?"
"The budget for that movie is quite a bit more than all the funding for research in virology. Keep that in mind. I guess it isn't sexy enough."
Arnie started to say something. Alex cut him off with a raised hand.
"I'm not on the government payroll anymore, sir. I don't have any empire to build. My research is privately funded. I'm just stating a fact. What the hell, I guess we can't fund everything."
"If we can't treat it, how do we stop it?" Ryan asked, getting things back on track. His head turned. A shadow crossed the south lawn, and the roar of a helicopter came through the bulletproof windows.
"Ah," Badrine observed with a smile. The Internet was designed to give access to information, not to conceal it. And from a friend of a friend of a friend who was a medical student at Emory University in Atlanta, he had the password to crack into that medical center's electronic mail. Another keyword eliminated all of the clutter, and there it was. It was 1,400 hours on America's East Coast, and Emory reported to CDC,
that it now had 6 cases of suspected hemorrhagic fever. Better yet, CDC had already replied, and that told him a lot more. Badrine printed up